So it's a thrill to be here. Thanks very much for the invitation to be involved in this session. And what I'll do is take you on a bit of a transition from the topic that we have been talking about earlier this morning, but I hope you'll find close links to the points made by our previous speakers. What I'd like to do is touch on these 5 points through this talk. First, what I'd like to do is make a link to the Soil Science Society strategic opportunity and connect policymakers then to the biofuel sector. So that's the example that I'll use to drill down through on this presentation. Through the talk, then, I'll touch on the global priorities for responding to climate change, looking at the way in which soil scientists in this community can be involved in developing sustainable forest bioenergy production systems, look at the policy frameworks that exist then for soil scientists to have input, and summarize then with some opportunities and challenges facing both the soils community and policymakers. So let's look at the link then to SSSA. And what I would do is start off with this charge to the Soil Science Society Soil Ecosystem Services Position Statement Working Group, short title. And as I was looking for a slide to start off this presentation and really wanting to make a point about what the overall message would be, what I wanted to do is point out how my remarks, I think, link directly to this statement then that's come out from Carl Glassner and Karen Beattie from the ASA. And there's a couple points here that I think are important for us to look at. One is that soils is the foundation for many aspects of human life. This statement then intends to touch on production-based services. You'll see biofuels listed in there as one of those. Ecosystem services, cultural and spiritual services, opportunities for supporting and regulating the Earth's ecosystems, and recognizing soil as an economic services context. So these are many of the points that have come out from our previous speakers. The objective of this position statement, then, is to engage SSSA in the policy issues that are related to these services and to inform policy making. Well, what's this going to require? How are we going to be successful in this? And how might we look at, then, the take-home messages, then, for soil scientists and for others? And what I would suggest is that the implied action items that will come from this are going to, one, be inward-looking. We need to have heightened focus of the soil science community on how we can contribute to these important areas. And two, we need to be outward-looking, and certainly the talks this morning touched on those. So as we've heard, we need to be clearly influencing, enabling legislation. If you think about where that flows on from then in the U.S. federal government, we need to be influencing appropriations committees and certainly society as a whole. So how can we make sure that the message is out there, that there's actually uptake in the critical committees that are creating the legislation, and that there's then dollars allocated towards that. But where I would like to take this presentation today is into looking at actually what I feel is the complexity of existing and emerging governance systems that certainly relate to all the topics that we'll talk about and are important in the bioenergy one. And some of that complexity then relates to the communities of actors that are involved in terms of governance and the way in which these systems are controlled, then the number of certification systems that are developing, the number of and overlap among national and international standards, and actually many of the commodity producer-driven initiatives that are out there. So these are what I would collectively describe as the way in which the governance then of this whole bioenergy sector comes together. And so as I go through these remarks, keep this aspects of inward looking and outward looking in mind, and we'll work our way through how soil scientists in particular might influence this system as it's developing. And what I would leave you with from the Canadian side of the border as an example of perhaps the red and blue map that we're so familiar with here in U.S. elections, these are actually the Ontario provincial vote results from the 7th of October. So we're just electing members of provincial parliament. You may not be familiar with the map of Ontario, but Toronto is down here on Lake Ontario. We've got this was what we call Southern Ontario. Here's Sault Ste. Marie is up here. Thunder Bay is up there. Look at the difference in the northern and southern voters in the province of Ontario. Look at the difference between rural and urban voters in the province as well. Two striking differences pop up in northern Ontario. One is the voters in the Thunder Bay area certainly are different from those in more remote areas. So we tend to have liberal voters in the areas around Thunder Bay. When you get out into the rural areas of northern Ontario, then you've got this NDP party that's very representing a very different voter constituency. Come down to southern Ontario, and you still have rather marked differences between the urban centers. So here's Ottawa. This must be Kingston here. We're talking Peterborough. Toronto is here, and you can see that Toronto, when you break out the voters there, actually has a difference between the core voters down near where our St. George campus is located for the University of Toronto versus those that are described as being in another area code, the 905. So we tend to have NDP voters down here. You've got a pretty strong Liberal vote here. But go out into the rural areas of southern Ontario, and you've got the Conservatives out in that area. So we tend to have these huge dichotomies. And as we talk about trying to influence government, as we talk about trying to influence the public, recognize that what's driving these different constituencies and areas can be rather stark. And I think this map, I hope this helps make that point to us and indicates clearly then how we need to be working with these different groups then to find out what makes them tick. How is it that our message will actually resonate with them? How is it that we have a message that will come through to them? So this is a point I would leave you with, and certainly you could take this back to your voting districts as well, and I'm sure you've got many of the same challenges. And those of us who are in academia, trying to bring forestry students into our programs, trying to bring soil science students into our programs, recognizes the way in which we're oftentimes working against these demographics then to attract people to our programs and bring them through. So this is something we need to adapt to. Let's move on then and ask how we might take this take these opportunities, if you will, and place these in a bioenergy context. And what I'll do is move next then to looking at the way in which we might respond to the global priorities here. This graph from the IEA efforts to look at where the emerging technologies might come from, I think is a good one for describing the way in which there's actually multiple solutions that need to be found. This graph points out if we take these issues and put it into kind of a pie-shaped series of wedges that we might contribute to, then clearly renewables here are described as maybe making about a 17% contribution. Many other areas of technology, of course, will also contribute to reducing our CO2 outputs there. But we're talking about a 50% cut, and clearly there is a wide range of ways in which we can do that. If we look specifically at how bioenergy might contribute to this, this same report was looking at total primary energy sources and describing how in the period of time between 2007 and 2050, how biomass might contribute to that. You can see here how there's then a projection of about a threefold increase in the biomass contribution. This would take us from, actually we're currently at about 50 exajoules for biomass contribution. This would go to about 140, very much substantially less than some other projections you may have seen, but this is probably one that's reasonable. But note again that biomass actually is one of multiple solutions here that are necessary to meet our energy requirements, and that this might then account for about 10% of the energy-related carbon dioxide emissions. But I think it's important for us to keep in perspective here that we're talking about biomass, hydro, nuclear, natural gas, oil and coal, and a variety of other solutions. It's clear that forests have an important role to play in this, and I think the IPCC statement from 2007 states it clearly. This is clearly an opportunity, but for many of us in academia, we realize that this statement is actually quite controversial, and whether or not we've got agreement, as we were talking about before, consensus among our colleagues is often a challenge, and this is actually one of the statements that even in our faculty is quite controversial. Whether we agree that sustainable forest management, as described by maintaining or increasing forest carbon stocks, as well as producing a sustained yield of timber, fiber, energy, is really where a lot of the dispute kind of lies. But clearly, one of the consensus points is that this will generate pretty large sustained mitigation benefit. But as we ask, then, how we're going to meet these challenges then in forestry, we have to ask which of these production systems might be considered sustainable in the parts of the world in which they lie. And as we zero in on any one location, if we look at this area in northern Maine along Chesuncook Lake, then we've been asking some questions here for a number of years about whether whole tree harvesting at landscape scales is sustainable. How might we drill down and look at any of the individual site impacts? How can we understand this on a watershed scale basis? As we move on into the number of topics that are important for us to address then in developing these sustainable systems, then we have to be sure to prevent unintended and negative consequences as described here with these Haitians protesting against UN peacekeepers demonstrating how they might have to eat grass because the price of their food crops is too high. And as we're looking at developing sustainable systems, we need to clearly recognize that we're looking at not only environmental and economic, but also social, and that all actors in the supply chain need to be considered in developing these systems. The point that I would like to leave us with here in terms of the complexity of governance, I hope is well described by this slide that talks about the actors that are involved in sustainable bioenergy systems. Earlier in our discussions, we're asking about how scientists can have influence on policymakers, but recognize they're not the only actors in this deal, and that we've got to have forest industry involved, that we've got to have communities, landowners, rural economic development groups, and others have to be part of this. And if there's a business going to go, then clearly it's got to be market-driven at some point. We've got to have a competitive business plan for this to go. So as we as soil scientists are trying to have impact on this, recognize that all these actors are actually involved in the whole scene there. So what's it going to take to develop these sustainable bioenergy production systems? I would argue that many of the practices that we've been working on for decades here to develop sustainably managed systems for conventional products actually can be used in a bioenergy context. But to do this, we need to clearly identify what the risks are to sustainability criteria and develop alternatives for mitigating those. If we look at a list then that involves the environmental, social, and economic values, then these are some that we would have on our list. The question we need to keep coming back to, and I would remind our colleagues here who we've been working on this for several decades, is how adequate is our knowledge? And can we assure society that we've got validated practices there? So our responsibility and challenge is to design low-impact systems and to figure out ways in which we can put this in a sustainability context for criteria and indicators. If you take a soil conservation example of how you would look at these criteria, we actually realize how complicated this is even for soil scientists. Sometimes we're talking about soil health, and I remember some discussions among our colleagues one time about whether soil health is actually a term we can buy into, and that's something that we want to be working towards. But we're also aware of concerns about nutrient balances and availability, base cation status, tree growth, and water quality. In doing our risk assessments, then, we need to be aware of when we're either trying to prevent damage or actually coming back in later to correct this. As we go back to any of the landscapes we're working on, we're all aware of the fact for the need for site-specific applicability. This area where we actually installed treatments 30 years ago this year, so back in 1981, we installed a series of treatments there on this range of soil types in northern Maine. We're just now starting to actually understand how these impacts are playing out in the long run. We're clearly not even close to the end of the first rotation in that ecosystem there. This was a landscape that actually had a well-described soil catena, but there's other areas that are more remote. If you go to northern Canada, in many cases, we're not classifying sites up there by soil series or placing them in a catena. So we may be looking at things like coarse, sandy to coarse loamy soils with a variety of forest types on them. So we have to recognize that as soil scientists, we've actually got a lot of places for us to have input. Is this the best classification system for stratifying that Canadian landscape? How well is this system adapted then to all those impacts that we're aware of being so important? We clearly have to answer the question about how intensive harvesting affects forest growth and yield across successive rotations. How well, for any of our sites, can we document what the sources of nutrients are in the second rotation and how our treatments are actually affecting those? How is it that growth of the forest is actually related to soil and site factors versus new genotypes and other things that may come in? And when we add climate change to that, then you clearly see how complicated it can get. If you look at the results from Weymouth Point, Jim McLaughlin, who's going to talk later in this session, went in with a colleague and at the 17-year point after harvesting, was able to document that whole tree harvesting had actually not led to depletions of carbon, nitrogen, or base cations. But we're keenly aware of how important deposition precip tends to be in terms of cation budgets. And at this point, still trying to unwrap the complexity then between the interactions between nitrogen deposition, organic matter, cation cycling over the course of a whole rotation is something we still need to work on. I'd like to get some colleagues go back up there for the 30th year resampling and see how that story is starting to play out. But clearly, in the context of bioenergy, we need to sort out what happened if we just went in there with a stem-only harvesting operation versus whole tree, and how does that relate to the natural ecosystem dynamics that are taking place there. If you put this then in the context of acid deposition in the Northeast, this map developed by ARP et al. in Canada clearly helps identify that we've got a huge range in soil parent materials there, and our risk assessments then not only need to include information about tree growth and nutrition, but we need to clearly link to off-site impacts and what the potential is then for cation budgets and watersheds. What's the policy framework within which we can anticipate this type of work taking place? And the question I would follow on and ask is what rational approaches can be used to guide the development of these systems, given uncertainty in the impacts of our management systems? This diagram showing the plan, do, check, review cycle that's so common in certification systems, I think is one that that describes that well, how we're seeking continual improvement in the face of uncertainty. This is typically placed in the framework for developing certification systems that we would argue is really essential for public acceptance. These are voluntary, market-driven approaches, so these don't depend on government decisions. These are things that the actors have concluded is important to maintain their market status, market accessibility. But the question that we need to ask, and where soil scientists can clearly play a role, is how easily applied are these systems, and when we're out measuring soil attributes, how well can these be audited? Can we actually demonstrate that we're measuring the right thing? We have to ask whether key stakeholders can find consensus here, and so we clearly need to be influencing that stakeholder audience there. And as we look at the multiple governance systems that are coming in now, we even have to start asking how we can be effective in helping to harmonize those as they develop. There actually is a lot of systems out there for defining CNI at the international level. This map is a good indication of how complex that landscape is. Much of the world has committed to the Montreal process, which, of course, the United States is signatory to and Canada has played a role in. This suite of seven criterion indicators is something that one would argue is in most certification systems that are out there. These are some ones that are applied in Canada and that are clearly part of that managed landscape there in Ontario. So the Forest Stewardship Council, SFI, and ISO 14000 are ones that you'll see commonly applied. The American Tree Farm System, of course, is quite important in the U.S. But these are ones that are out of a list of about 50 that are developing worldwide now. The landscape is getting really complicated in these certification systems. And we actually have new actors emerging all the time. And so I'm sure you're familiar with the Roundtable on Sustainable Biofuels, RSB. If you look at their Principle 8, it deals with soils. And so clearly soil scientists have a role to play here. But I would ask my colleagues here to drill into what's being proposed as their principles. We're seeking to reverse soil degradation and or maintain soil health. If you look at Criterion 8A, it talks about maintaining or enhancing soil physical, chemical, biological conditions. Feedstock producers must comply with this, and when you get down to the minimum requirements, we start talking about soil erosion, maintaining or enhancing soil organic matter, long-term soil stability and organic matter content. Well, anybody here who's tested hypotheses about the impacts of our harvesting operations will recognize the challenge associated with the word choice here and the things that would actually be measured. How would you actually go out and measure these things on the landscape in a managed forest? How would you make sure the auditors are in a position to do this? So as we start to see these systems developing, I think you can recognize there's a clear need for our involvement in that. Kathy Abuso from SFI would argue that GLORA's global forest certification is a bit of an alphabet soup. But recognize that with these 50 certification systems that are out there now, the governance is increasingly complex. In many cases, our federal and state governments aren't even involved in this. This is playing out with actors' involvement. And I think if you look at this simple diagram of a biofuel supply chain and the return of carbon dioxide back to the landscape, you can see that if you examine the whole supply chain and look at where these systems might apply, there's potential for some complexity and perhaps negative ways in which the supply chain might flow. There clearly is overlapping jurisdiction over the whole chain of custody here, then as you track from the forest to consumers. There's the possibility that trade could be restricted, so we could actually, in this complexity, reduce the way in which these systems are being deployed. And so the question that's being asked now, certainly within IEA Bioenergy, and I think what represents an opportunity for the soil science community then is to ask how these systems can be harmonized. The other issue we need to be aware of, clearly globally, is that certified forests are only 10% of the forests of the world. There's another 90% that are out there that aren't under these systems at all, so we need to be conscious of that. In our work with colleagues, we've asked how well these certification systems are working, and we've examined then whether they include the relevant general criteria. Yep, most of them do that. Do they recognize the benefits of bioenergy, encourage their use? Yep. Do they fit well within the wider governance framework that's out there? Yeah, most of them probably do. But if we ask how specifically they've been adapted for biofuels, we see that many of them may not. They may not actually include forest biofuels in their management plans and may not address some of the critical issues that are involved. So what are the challenges and opportunities here that we have as a community with policymakers? We find that we can implement these to produce feedstocks. Sustainable forest management, adaptive management approaches can be applied. But to do this, we need to implement them at a site-specific level. We need to look at long-term impacts, and clearly, we need to get on with this. We've got this range of the strength of our evidence, and the question I would ask my colleagues here is, what progress are we actually making on empirical validation? If you look at the network of sites that are out there, we need to be asking, do we have enough? Are they well distributed? Point out some of the recent global meta-analysis efforts that have been taking place to synthesize our knowledge here. But we've got many areas where the soils, if you look at this map of southern Ontario, the soils aren't even classified in the information that's up on our national systems there. And we all may be aware of the challenges for the way in which our classification systems work in assessing these risks. As we kick in new criteria for sustainability and ask how life cycle analysis can be applied, then we have to ask how many environmental variables can we deal with in this kind of a framework beyond just carbon dioxide. So I'll conclude here by just saying that clearly policymakers should acknowledge the potential for these systems to be sustainable. We have ways in which we can put sustainable systems in place, but we have to identify the risks. But the benefits and threats should be addressed with input, clearly, of the soil science community, working to adapt locally with site-specific knowledge and broad stakeholder input. Thanks very much. I agree with you, if I understand your question, that criterion indicators are an essential way to frame it up. I think they're clearly the only way in which you can kind of focus on what's the list of things we need to achieve and then how would we do that. The devil is in the detail, though, in the way in which you drill down to things that you can actually measure, in the way in which you can look at the relationship between management activity and an outcome. And we need to make sure then that the criteria aren't things you can kind of drive a truck through, but they're actually something that is meaningful. We're all aware of the way in which many indicators have been phrased as very global kinds of statements, that if you actually ask about the relationship between the treatment that's been imposed and the response variable that you're interested in measuring, in many cases it's a very difficult relationship to quantify. And so that's where I just get back to questions about how well can we apply the systems that are being put in place. I think the framework that is being proposed is a very logical one, but where there clearly needs to be more science community input is the knowledge at the way in which these things work at the ecosystem level. How much are they based on mechanistic processes that have been tested and evaluated and that we now have reliable systems that do that? Or are we still back really at kind of the hypothesis generation level? And I would argue that we're perhaps lagging a bit more in that regard than many of us would be comfortable with.
Thank you, Jeff.
Thanks very much.